If you enjoy Astronomy FM Radio, please let us know with a small donation. We do rely on your support, and it's true. Every little bit counts.
AFM. You're listening to AFM Radio on astronomy.fm, around the world and beyond.
Arr. Coming up next, it's time for an AFM Radio original program, Space Pirate Radio, brought to you by the Voice of Astronomy MIDI. This is astronomy.fm.
The pirates are coming. The pirates are coming. The pirates are coming. The
abyss. Arr. It's Space Pirate Radio time, fuckos, here on astronomy.fm radio. That means it is another Wednesday evening. This one is April the 19th, 2017, 9 o'clock in the evening for those of us here in the eastern portion of North America. So that means we have our chat room wide open right now. So come on over and join us. Get here two different ways. Just type directly astronomy.fm/chat or go to the homepage. You'll see where it says radio chat. Click on that. And you'll be here, so consider you part of our crew. You can join the chat room. More than welcome to have you ask us questions. We're going to put links to the stories that we're talking about, so that will give you a chance to do some further reading. Let's say hi to everybody that's in here so far. We've got me, Andre, Glenn, Black Projects, Guy Guy Nick, Twist Edge, Aquafew, Richie, Plaid Joan, Evil Spock, Plaid and Mac. Diane will be here just a second.
I'm here.
She's here already. So we're doing good. So, yeah, a couple technical glitches this week. Like, we got most of them straightened out. We'll see how that goes. I couldn't listen into the show earlier. So, and I know we had some little on and off stuff. So we had a little crash. And we're mostly caught up with it, I think. So we'll see how it goes. But, yep. Just a technical glitch that sometimes happen with technology. These space pirate ships, you know. What happened to the good old days with ropes and sails?
That's what happens when you steal parts from other ships and cobble them together to make your own, right? Right.
Well, that is true. I can't fight that one. Yeah, especially those alien ships. Not that there's aliens out there.
Mm-hmm. All right. No aliens here, but us.
That's right. The rest of them are listening into our show.
Yep.
All right, everybody. Welcome to Wednesday evening again, Space Pirate Radio. Let's see what we got. I want to start with our traditional sun stuff, because we got actually something to talk about a little bit. Sunspot is the one that was around, remember, a couple weeks ago?
Yeah, it was a nice one, actually.
Yeah, well, there was two of them. There was the really big one, but ahead of that one was a smaller one. The smaller one looks like it's come back. Looks like it's pretty active, been flaring. It's now designated 2651 since it came all the way around, but it's probably the forward one that was here before. And it has been flaring, blew off a class 3 or class G5 or something like that flare, but it was basically sideways. So that's going to pretty much miss us, but definitely a good time to get back looking at the sun again. We'll see if the next one that was following it comes around. Now, this one does look reduced. Basically, it's three spots, a little bit of action all around it. But in the light of ultraviolet, it looks fairly active. So keep checking it out. Definitely blowing some stuff off. Solar wind is a bit up and a little bit dense. Not incredibly well, but the speed of the solar wind is 455 kilometers per second. That's just kind of moderate. Density is up to almost 15 protons per cubic centimeter. So that would mean some high-latitude aurora observers. Keep an eye out. Should see some good stuff coming up. And keep an eye on the sun, too. We'll see what kind of spots kind of come on around the corner. It definitely looks like there's going to be some stuff doing that. So if you want to check the SOHO website, you can do that to keep track of it.
I had a funny conversation about aurora yesterday with two of my coworkers.
Okay.
And one of them had been up to Michigan's Upper Peninsula because his daughter is about to start school at Michigan Tech University,
uh-huh.
which is quite far north, well past the 45th parallel,
yes.
which is very far from the U.S., outside of Alaska. And he was raving about how there's the best place to see the Northern Lights. It's this hill up in Copper Harbor. And I laughed at it. I'm sure that's a good place, but it's not the geography that dictates seeing the northern lights. It's what the sun is doing. So yes. You can stand on that hill all night, and if the sun is at minimum, you'll see stars. It'll be nice, but no.
So we'll see what happens. It looks like we still got some stuff coming around. Not going to last forever. We will hit minimum. We're definitely okay. We thought we were at minimum because there was so much dead time on the sun, but still got some activities, so it's doing okay. Gonna sneeze here. Muted sneeze. That's much better. All right, so check the sun out. It's doing pretty good. Had a rock fly by today. One I was talking about for the past couple of months or so. It was
quite a bit of media play.
Oh, definitely hit a lot of media play, but for us, it was only barely worth mentioning.
Yeah, you know, not like, one of the better ones.
No, this was like an okay space rock. I've been talking about it for a couple of months, but anything over, you know, one lunar distance, I don't consider it to be very close at all. And this was like four lunar distances, so put it like about a million miles away, and well, the press kind of hyped it up.
Yeah, like
but that's okay.
Sample headline. Asteroid will not destroy Earth today, but let's consider that for a moment, which is a nice enough educational article, but this asteroid, which has variously been compared to a peanut shape or dumbbell shape.
Mm-hmm. There's some radar images of it that look pretty cool.
Yeah, no, yeah, there's some good images, but it was larger than thought, but it's, you know, 0.8 miles wide. But it wasn't that close.
Right. Million miles. That's four times farther than the moon. So not really good close for the public, sort of. But not for astronomers. I mean, if you wanted to observe it, I think I calculated it flew by at about, 8 o'clock this morning for our time. And they said it was coming from the sunny side, so could not have seen it that way anyway. So I had to wait till it actually passed by. So anytime now, you can try looking for it. I didn't look for a chart for it. I should have done that for everybody. Sorry I didn't do that. But they expect it to be like 11th magnitude. So definitely quite a challenge for a moving object. Close by the Earth, it could move pretty fast too. A million miles away, I don't know, it might move half a degree in like 10 minutes. Just my rough guess. And that's actually pretty fast. So you have to like be able to figure out where it's actually going to be. Look at it for a fair amount of time, and you should be able to actually see motion if it's in a fairly star-filled region. But 11th magnitude, that's a tough one for, you know, on the edge of a 6-inch, 8 would have a challenge to it. So anything
8 inches in lousy skies
would not be able to see it probably. So the designation for it, by the way, was 2014JO25. I tried to get the orbital diagram for it from JPL, but I was reading some stuff about they're actually not supporting Java anymore at all, even though it's
interesting.
The diagram is in Java and it hasn't been working for me, and there's supposed to be these workarounds to be able to see it. I think, who was it? Was it Nick actually found it? Oh, which I forgot to check again, like on a minor planet something or other site. Oh, maybe I'll get Nick to find that again. But that would actually show the orbital diagram. I don't think it was interactive. The old one was interactive where you could actually click and drag and move it up and down and move it around and get a little different viewer. But it's definitely not from the JPL small body database browser. You cannot see the orbital diagram from there. But one thing I did do, which was I went down to I started out with spaceweather.com. Down at the bottom, it says Near Earth Asteroid, so you can go down and look. It says it's listed there. Clicked on it, went to JPL, and then clicked way down farther where there's just like a whole bunch of close approach data is what it's called. Found the date, scrolled across where it says JD TDB. I don't know what TDB means, but JD means Julian date.
To be determined.
No, it would be the other way. To determined be. TDB. Huh, a little bit backwards. Let me put this link into our chat room here real quick.
Yes, please.
All right, let's see where we at. Here we go. Here's the JPL thing. So scroll down, found the Julian date for it. Now, hard to calculate, but I was able to find another spot where it's a Julian date converter. That is from the U.S. Naval Observatory. They also published the Astronomical Almanac online. So let me put that link into the chat room. Here it comes. I definitely got this one bookmarked. Save this because it'll give you a big hint. All right, there it is. So I just highlighted and copied the Julian date from JPL site, and I put the data into the little window for the Julian date converter, clicked compute calendar date, and it popped out when it was actually going to fly by in universal time. So that basically told me what time it was actually going to fly by at 8 o'clock this morning for my time. So basically for pretty much anybody tonight, you have a chance of seeing it before it gets too far away. But at least it gave me an idea. Of course, we've got clouds here. No chance to be able to see it for me anyway. So, oh, well.
Well, what can we see up there in the sky, Marty?
Well,
from clouds?
What we can see is tonight is the last quarter moon. Tomorrow, Mercury's inferior conjunction. I already checked this out. It's 2 degrees from the sun. I didn't look to see if it was going to be north or south, but close enough to not be able to see it. I'm not even going to try for this one. Pluto stationary, well, it just means the Earth orbit is going around the corner, and we're actually aiming straight towards Pluto, which kind of puts it on the horizon at sunset type of thing. Saturday, Neptune, 0.2 degrees north of the moon, and there will be an occultation. I did have a chance to look this one up, so it looks like Eastern Australia. Hey, Rob Black.
Nice.
Rob Black should be able to see this just before the sun rises. It's Saturday, April 22nd at 20 hours, somewhere around there. You can actually watch the moon, very thin crescent moon, go in front of the planet Neptune. Sunday, Venus will be 5 degrees north of the moon. And I didn't look up this occultation of the moon in Pallas, but since it's like 2 days before new moon, I thought it'd be kind of a tough one to see anyways.
Yeah, though a crescent moon occulting anything is pretty neat, depending on where exactly the object is reappearing from or disappearing from, because, of course, you can't, artistic depictions aside, you can't see anything through the crescent of the moon.
Right.
But why? So watching a star or, you know, in this case, a planet or asteroid just wink out of existence with the moon hanging right there is pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. I think it's going to, the bright side, the very thin crescent of the moon will be covering Neptune, and then it'll come out the dark side.
Neat.
I should have looked up this Pallas one because there's something I wanted to check. On Monday, the 24th, Pallas will be 0.8 degrees south of the moon, and there will be an occultation. This time of year, the moon is starting to get down towards, and our ecliptic is getting low to our southern horizon, especially towards the middle of the summer. Our ecliptic runs really, really low. Now, when you have an object with the moon, the farther south you are, it makes the moon appear farther north. And the farther north you live, it makes the moon appear farther south. So this one with the moon, sorry, with Neptune like 0.2 of a degree north of the moon, but with the moon so far south, you have to go really, really far south in order for the moon to cover it. Now, that's not true in the wintertime because the moon's much higher in our sky and it's easier to have, you know, more to bring the moon in the other direction. So I should have looked up Pallas because it's in the opposite direction. So Pallas is actually south of the moon. So the farther north you are on the Earth, it makes the moon appear farther south to background objects. So we might have a chance of seeing Pallas go behind the moon, being farther north, because that one's going to be 0.8 degrees south of the moon. So it might do it from our area, except for the, let's see, the 16 hours just before, a couple days before new moon, early in the morning. It's possible. What's 16 hours? Minus 4 hours, 12 o'clock in the afternoon. I don't think we're going to see that one, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, it's even tough for me to convert to universal time to local time sometimes. It doesn't look like it would be visible from our area anyway. So, but I think somewhere in the north, somewhere the opposite of us, so somewhere around maybe Eastern Asia might have a chance like that for Pallas. I didn't look that one in detail because, minor planets. Just didn't bother with that one. Not an easy one to see. All right, so a few things going on for the moon and planets and stuff like that. Still planets out there in the early evening, obviously. So, in fact, I think Mars is actually still out there. It's getting pretty far away from us, so... You can see Mars, and you might want to do that just for the heck of it after the sun goes down, but not really that impressive. Let me get some nighttime sky on my star chart here. So, there you go. All right, yeah, so just after the sun goes down, technically Mars is still low towards the west, but it's definitely down there.
The big thing in the evening sky is definitely Jupiter.
Definitely Jupiter.
Can't emphasize that enough.
Yep. And then Saturn's rising like, around 1 o'clock, midnight, something like that, if I'm not mistaken. So Jupiter, and then you get to wait for Saturn, but it's coming around again. Didn't get to see didn't hear any reports of anybody observing Jupiter during opposition on the 7th.
Nope, not me.
That shadow transfer event that I've been talking about was not visible in our area. So somewhere around Eastern Europe would have a chance for it, but I didn't hear of any reports of anybody actually seeing it or imaging it. That would have been pretty nice. So maybe they didn't know about it. More people should listen to us, I think. So still a little bit of all the Orion constellations coming up. But... we're starting to lose that now, and time to go galaxy hunting.
Yes, springtime galaxy season.
Springtime here in the north, that is
true.
I should say, but
many of the galaxies are particularly well positioned for northern observers. At least the Coma Cluster.
Mm-hmm. But we got Leo, basically, so that's ecliptic. So,
Leo's good. Leo's nice and equitable.
Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of galaxies out there, and they're not that hard to see. A lot of them are about 6 magnitude, 7 magnitude, 8 magnitude, stuff like that. So,
small telescopes, binocular objects even. Leo's got some very good galaxies that, with a truly dark sky, you can pick them up easily enough in, say, 15 by 70 binoculars.
That's correct. Yeah, darker skies are better. You can get them into most of your finder scopes too, so you can kind of do a little bit of just kind of scan that area and point your scope, your finder scope, at any little fuzzy spot, look in your main scope, and you'll see that, yep, it's a galaxy, and most likely it will be one of the Messier galaxies, but not necessarily. Surprisingly, Messier did not get so many of the brighter, still kind of brighter galaxies in that area that were not that hard to see.
Well, to be fair, there's a lot of galaxies. And given that that's not what the man was looking for, I can forgive him for missing a few.
Yes, but it would be real easy to miss miss a comet in that realm of galaxies. In Virgo there, Virgo Cluster. By the way, Virgo Cluster is kind of a famous cluster of galaxies. It's about 60 million light years away. So when somebody asked me, how far away can I see with my scope? I generally immediately refer to the Virgo Cluster and say, I've seen galaxies 60 million light years away.
Yeah, I think, let's see, the best, the farthest detectable galaxy that I think I've seen with the binoculars was 72 million. Okay. One of the Messier objects, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but 60 is easy enough, given a dark sky. Now, yeah. Aquifer, you mentioned M106, which is up in Ursa Major, so very okay. well positioned for northern observers. And he said that it's a very bright and not too shabby, and I wanted to mention that specifically because in one of the earliest observing sessions when my husband and I were using our brand new 8-inch Orion Dob up north, you know, in 6-magnitude skies in of northern Michigan on Lake Huron, he stumbled across that one. And in our 8-inch, it looked a bit paisley-shaped. Mm-hmm. And so he found it, and then afterwards he researched it and was able to identify it. And because he did stumble across it while we were looking for other things, that became a particularly special object to him. Mm-hmm. So if you have the opportunity to go looking for M106 in Ursa Major, check it out. It's a nice galaxy.
Is there a distance on that one?
Let's see.
Is it special because it's so much? Is it a bit farther away? Couple galaxies.
No, I mean it's just cool looking. I agree that at least under the conditions that we were viewing at the time, it's got a paisley shape. It's not that far away. I think it's 22-ish million light years.
Okay.
Yeah.
There are a couple of popular galaxy clusters out there. Virgo is one of them.
Yes.
Nearby, Como Brindisi is another one. And then there is, I think, an Ursa Major cluster, too, if I'm not mistaken.
The Ursa Major's got a lot of objects.
Yeah.
Now, the Como cluster's cool because Como Brindisi is not a particularly standout constellation. The way that I remember and the way that I tell people how you find this
well,
is...
Well, it is and it isn't.
Look for the tuft in the lion's tail. Mm-hmm. Because if you're just looking for this shape of stars, this classic stick figure, you may have a difficult time. But if you go looking for the tuft trailing Leo, it's pretty easy to find in a good dark sky.
Yeah, it's actually like a blob of stars. Como Brindisi's hair. So, yeah, you'll actually kind of notice is that like it's like a faint, really big star cluster. Kind of like Pleiades, but bigger. What are some of the other one? Asterism cluster-like things like that. But yeah, kind of like that, or on a fainter scale, the Beehive cluster. Yes, Persephone.
Yep.
So it's kind of like that, but much bigger, covering maybe like 4 or 5 degrees, something like that. So you'll definitely see that big cluster of stars, and they're better naked eye or through binoculars. And then when you use a telescope, you start looking through it, and then you kind of lose the individual stars. And it doesn't quite look like a cluster when you're using a telescope with it. But lots of galaxies out there. So this is the time of year for this April time of year is definitely time to go look for galaxies.
So it is a good time to appreciate the cluster that you mentioned, the Beehive M44 in Cancer.
Yes.
Which is another unremarkable constellation that happens to have an amazing object in it. So we've talked about the Beehive because it's so cool, but it is a open cluster of stars. It looks under a truly dark sky like a fuzzy patch. You can see it. And it was thought in classical times by Western Europeans or people in the Mediterranean to be a gate where souls pass through.
Hmm.
Oh, but it also looks like a beehive with the stars being, you know, the bees.
Mm-hmm. Bees buzzing around their hive.
Bees buzzing around the hive. Or the constellation Cancer has two stars that are called the Northern Donkey and the Southern Donkey. Actually, they're called something else, but I'm not saying that on the air.
Okay.
Yeah, donkeys is what we'll call them. And they are eating out of a manger. And in that case, the fuzzy patch is not bees or souls, but hay.
Hey.
Yeah, hey.
Hey. Okay.
It's a fun object.
Yep. Jupiter, by the way, is right in the middle of Virgo.
Yeah, it's been hanging out near Spica. And even though Spica is quite a bright and nice star, in the company of Jupiter, it's literally outshone.
Now, there's one that I like, a constellation just a little bit south of Virgo. It's a lopsided square. It's called Corvus the Crow.
Ah, yes. I love that constellation.
It's got one of my favorite galaxies inside of it, and that happens to be M104, Sombrero Nebula, Sombrero Galaxy.
Formerly called the Nebula.
Yes, yeah, sorry, old school there. So, yes. Sombrero Galaxy. It's the one with that dark line going through it, but not vertically, like horizontally. The vertical one's M82 and Big Dipper. The horizontal ones.
It's an amazing object.
Yep. And what's unusual from the northeast star called Agorab in Corvus there, if you keep going towards the northeast, there's a couple of asterisms that one of them is like a little sagitta, and it points right at M104 galaxy.
Well, sagitta is actually an authentic constellation. It's a ridiculous little constellation, but it's...
Yes. Well, this is kind of like a miniature version of sagitta.
It's like
a quarter of a degree, a little asterism, and it basically is lined up and points right towards M104. So it's kind of cool. So you'll see if you can find that little asterism.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. Actually, there's like several asterisms there. There's kind of like a couple of just kind of pointer stars. It points to kind of like a little Y-shaped asterism. And then if you keep on going, the Y-shaped asterism's got like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 stars in it. And then you keep on going towards the northeast, and then you'll get that little sagitta, which has got like 2 stars where the arrow feathers would be, and then a couple more for around the shaft where the point is. And then that points right to M104. I always like that, all of that too. The little asterisms, that couple of them that point right to M104 of the galaxy out there. Never taken a picture of that. I should do that sometime. Oh, let's see where we're at here. Oh, not quite halfway. Yeah, so we got several articles to talk about. Some kind of stuff that's been hitting the popular news and Facebooks and stuff, like negative mass. Have you been hearing about negative mass?
Okay. I had some fairly exciting conversations with people about it at work.
Okay. So obviously a little bit more blown up. Let me put that article into our chat room. This is from the BBC News, by the way, so you can do a little bit more further reading on that. Definitely legitimate physics here. Now, it's not something that I would usually say for the end of the show. And I could make a joke about it, but I won't do that. So. Let's see. So what it is now it's not like big, huge amounts of stuff. It's just kind of like really, really working with really, really small particles. What they did was they chilled something called rubidium to almost absolute zero, really, really close. And then they used lasers to trap the atoms, and they could basically move them kind of back and forth. And it turns out that they would actually, if you pushed on it, it kind of repelled the pushing and moved backwards.
Yeah, with negative mass, if you push something, it would accelerate toward you.
Right. More power to the shields. More power to the shields. Do you remember that episode?
Nope. Don't All even right. know whether you're making a Next Generation or original series reference.
This is a Next Generation reference to it, where they find this kid, I think, in a mostly destroyed starship. And he's like the only survivor, and he's the one that starts imitating Data. He's like a mini-me Data. And they think it's to overcome the tragedy that he suffered. And then so they come up across the same energy field, and they bring up their shields, and they get hammered, and then it gets stronger. Every time another wave comes at them, they get hammered even harder. And then at the end, the kid says, you know, well, somebody like the captain says, more power to the shields. And then the kid says, more power to the shields. That's what the last thing that they said before this gigantic wave, energy wave hit them and basically destroyed them. So they figured out, of course, miraculously, at the last second that it was the shields were actually powering the wave. So what they did was they shut the shields off, and they barely got hit by a little tap. And that basically fixed the problem. So if they would have put every available power into the shields, it would have destroyed them because it would push back so hard. It's kind of like Star Trek doing negative mass. Kind of came up with that idea. The more you push it, the more it pushes back. I remember that episode. So that's what I thought when I saw this article on negative mass pushing it back.
It definitely was not what I expected for water cooler chatter at work last week. So it was cool that any of my colleagues were, you know, fired up about the idea.
Mm-hmm. So we kind of had two things. The negative mass and then the rock that flew by hit the news. So at least some astronomy, you know, is getting in the news
Yeah, not just the pink moon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I like that there's the incentive for people to go out and pay attention to the moon and get in tune with, you know, full moons, new moons and all that. But every month this wave of whatever the Farmer's Almanac moon name is for the month is just, again.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the more people get internalizing what the cycles of the moon are, the fewer people are going to think the moon in the daytime is a UFO. So that's cool.
Mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, we're halfway through our program right now, so that must mean that you are listening to Space Pirate Radio here on astronomy.fm. Tis another Wednesday evening, and this one happens to be April the 19th, 2017, at 9:32 in the eastern portion of North America, Universal Time. That would put it at 1:32 on April the 20th, Thursday morning, also 2017. So we just did half our program. We got another half still to go live. And don't forget, during the live portion, we've got our chat room wide open. I always like to invite everyone to come on over to the chat room if you want to ask us questions. Of course, we'll put links to the articles that we're talking about so you can do some further reading there. Let's say hi to everybody there. So we've got me and you. We've got Andre, Glenn, Black Projects, Twist Edge, Aqua for You, Plaid Joan, Evil Stock, Spot, Plaid Mac, and Richie now joins us in our chat room. Appreciate you being here. Don't forget, we got other programming coming up after Space Pirate Radio. I'm assuming it's our usual rundown of Astronomy Ireland, Planetary Radio, Planetary Society, Naked Astronomer, Naked Scientist, all coming up after Space Pirate Radio. So stick around. But don't worry, if you miss some of it, we're going to repeat the programming every 4 hours for the next 24 hours. Oh, let's see. We've got all kinds of stuff going on lately.
We have a meteor shower coming up.
Do we? Let's see. Yeah. What is this? April?
It is April.
I'm not too familiar with what's there. Which one is it?
Coming from Lyra.
Ah, that must be called the Lyrids.
Indeed. So they're going to be peaking the night of April 21st, so the morning of the 22nd. And, you know, they're not one of the more famed meteor showers, but they're known for putting on a pretty nice display, and conditions should be really good this year. So you're going to have a waning moon that's not rising until about 4 a.m. local daylight time. And since it's a waning crescent, it's not going to pollute the sky that much. So if you want to be up early in the morning, you know, sometime between midnight and 4 a.m., you might be picking up 20 meteors an hour.
Mm-hmm. Darker skies, the better.
Darker skies, the better. Bundle up, grab yourself a mug of hot coffee, tea, or chocolate, get out in a lawn chair with a blanket. Sit back, chill, look for meteors.
And or plan on just observing other stuff.
Yeah.
To kill a bunch of time in the evening and at nighttime and just basically look around. Sometimes a general observing for something like this, you might actually find more meteors going through your telescope than you do through the sky without a telescope. You generally see the smaller, fainter ones through your telescope. You'd be surprised how many you can see meteors you can actually see going through your telescope field during a shower. So hopefully you get good weather. Moon's just right. Galaxy hunting weekend.
Yeah.
And some observing. A little bit of planetary stuff. Jupiter. Don't forget, you can look up Jupiter's moons, what's happening with them at inthesky.org and Pluto Project.
Go out to your favorite local observatory, make a night out of it, look at Jupiter, look at some galaxies, look at Saturn, watch for meteors, wait till the moon comes up, you're good.
Yep. And the weather for pretty much everybody is moderate right now. So
yes.
The southern hemisphere getting cooler, northern hemisphere is getting warmer, kind of got mostly equal daytime and nighttime, so it's not so bad about, you know, getting some reasonably early nighttime sky. You don't have to wait too late for. So not so bad. Just a good time of year for just general observing, stuff like that.
No, it's actually our astronomy club's open house this weekend. So I've got my fingers crossed that we'll have good skies for the first time this year.
Yeah. Looks like they're going to be clear?
Yeah,
that's another issue.
I hesitate even to say, because honestly, the weather predictions and what we've actually been hit with have not been remotely comparable. For instance, this past weekend was supposed to be thunderstorms all weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Not a drop. It was not clear, but it was not thunderstorms. And yeah, basically every day has been not exactly as predicted. So I'm hoping we have nice, moderate weather, clear skies. You know, not a lot of haze, but it's April.
Yeah.
It could do anything.
I hate that in between you can see stars, but you can't see through the clouds type of night. You
know, except like for holes.
So much, so much high, thin clouds. Doesn't make it worth going out, but you can look up and see some general stars. So it's like, not worth going out doing any observing. Not clear enough. I want it either like totally cloudy or totally clear. Nothing fuzzy in between. I'll even take up some kind of broken clouds, but nothing as far as like that fuzzy, hazy junk that gets up there. Yeah, that really ruins everything more. Kind of like a full moon. Oh, let's see. Discovery of a minor planet beyond Pluto shows there might not be a Planet 9 after all.
Surprise, surprise, surprise.
I know. Let me put that link into our chat room here. No. Yeah. Only partly read this article, but it looks like the evidence for a sort of a major Neptune-sized planet out there is getting smaller and smaller. They thought there were some deviations in a bunch of other little
orbits. Many
planets that there was enough deviation to contribute it to a sort of a major but really far away, farther planet. But now it's looking like, it's not true. Just a bunch of little planets out there, and their orbits are their orbits, and it doesn't look like it's really caused by a major, disruptor out there.
Are you shocked, Marty?
No, not at all, actually.
Me either, no.
Yeah, there's been so many people looking for big planets out there. I mean, way back to even the Clyde Tombaugh days. He said they didn't just stop at Pluto, but they kept going. And with his photography back then, he says, there's really nothing fainter than 20th magnitude out there beyond Pluto. So obviously some of the little ones are, smaller and pretty, pretty faint. But anything that would make it would be a fairly large planet, would be reasonably detectable even back in the 30s when they were imaging like that. And they've been imaging ever since then. So, no, it doesn't surprise me that there's not a big planet out there. Now, there's still going to be some really far out there.
Hey, I'm fine with people looking. It's just that it was very much hyped. It was hyped by some of the same people who brought you the demotion of Pluto,
mm-hmm.
and therefore had a little bit of an angle,
mm-hmm.
bit of bias at the table, you might say, about what Planet 9 actually ought to be. And as the article that you're linked to pointed out, it was based on a pretty small sample size. We know of a limited number of trans-Neptunian objects, some of which are weird. Mm-hmm. Based on these weird ones, you can come up with a model for where this larger-than-Earth missing planet ought to be. But, well, there's been a lot of beautifully calculated hypothetical planets that never existed. Mm-hmm. And this may very well be one of them. Mm-hmm. And the more trans-Neptunian objects that they find, it could turn out, yeah, there's no pattern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Aqua says, what should they name Planet 9 if it's found? How about something Scamarian? It's a scam, oh. So Scamarian. Yes. That's what I should think you should call it. Scamarian. Yeah, just my opinion.
How much money do we have to send to get that made official, Marty? Where do the checks go?
Well, if we're going to do that, I'm going to name it after me.
Oh, okay. Well, let's talk about a different...
There goes. Glenn goes, how about Bubba?
No.
That'll work.
Let's talk about a different sort of small object in the vicinity of Neptune, which is Triton. And Triton has not really been visited by probes since the Voyager days, which at this point was a fairly long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember about when that happened. It was the end of the 1980s, and Triton was cool. It had an atmosphere. It had very few craters, suggesting there was something going on with it. And it was at that time, it was the first active satellite imaged, because we didn't have the phenomenal data that we now do on these very interesting moons of Jupiter and Saturn and Pluto.
Mm-hmm.
So Triton, since that time, has kind of been neglected. So it's interesting that it travels around Neptune backward, suggesting that it is one of these Kuiper Belt objects that got napped by Neptune's gravity.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we now believe that Triton had an ocean. So it's been very exciting, all of these worlds out there that were, okay, Ganymede has an ocean or the crust, Europa has an ocean. Well, Triton, it seems, did too. And the existence of that ocean, which may or may not still exist, would explain some of the surface details that Voyager captured without relying on, say, the same mechanism that makes the Jovian moons do the things that they do.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, it's a kind of a cool write-up in astronomy with some nice pictures, vintage pictures, but very nice ones. And I do think that it's time that we pay this presumably captured TNO a bit of attention.
Sure. Let's see. I didn't get to read this article, which I really need to read in depth, because it's never quite as straightforward as you think they are. But this one is from space.com. Astronomers capture the first image of the dark matter that holds the universe together.
Ew. I didn't get that one.
All right, let me put that into our chat room here. And image is usually, yes, like one of those, yes, sort of type of ways of saying it. I think this is a radio. I think what they've got is some sort of a radio image, which doesn't give you like a picture, but they will, you know, pick up radio frequencies, and, you know, the bigger the antenna, they can kind of pinpoint different areas that have that same frequency or that same strength, wavelength, and stuff like that. So I think they're seeing a radio connection between two galaxies or something like that. I didn't read this article, so just sort of half-guessing here.
Composite image of a dark matter filament connecting galaxies together.
Hmm.
The professor of astronomy at the University of Waterloo in Canada, the co-author of this study that's being published in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society, says this image moves us beyond predictions related to dark matter into something we can see and measure. Hey, that's quite interesting.
But what are they seeing? You know, obviously dark matter, kind of like a black hole, is not visible unless it's, you can see the effect of it. So what are they saying that they're actually seeing? So there's combined lensing data from from a multi-year sky survey at the Canada, France, with information from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey that mapped luminous red galaxies, which are massive, distant, and very old galaxies.
Hmm.
Let's see. The average galaxy can live in more massive dark matter halos. So, the usual way of detecting what, you know, excessive amounts of gravity is by looking at a galaxy, and if it basically gravitationally lenses something behind it, and then you calculate how much matter that foreground galaxy would actually have to have in order to create that much of a lens effect, and then look at the visible portions of the galaxy and figure out mathematically how many stars that equals to. And if it equals to the amount of gravity that it should do that lensing, okay, that's just saying basically there's a lot of stars there. But what happens is that they measure all the stars in the galaxy, and they say, well, this is not enough stars to make this much gravity. So lately they're saying it's something that's not visible that makes a lot of gravity. It was able to bend the light from behind the galaxy around it and send it towards us. That's the usual way of detecting dark matter. But it really depends on how well you can actually see the stars that are in the galaxy. Oh, we'll see.
Well, you mentioned of observing a black hole. So the follow-up story that I've got deals with exactly that.
Yeah, I've got the same thing.
And I recommend reading the whole article because it's a fascinating story of a multi-telescope coordination involving a network of radio telescopes based everywhere from Spain to Hawaii to the South Pole.
Mm-hmm.
That earlier this month did a five-night observing run to capture a portrait of the event horizon of the black hole at the center of the Milky Way. And it sounds like they pulled it off. The article opens with a team member cracking open a 50-year-old bottle of scotch, which that sounds like a fine way to celebrate. And they are looking forward to testing some of the basic predictions of Einstein's theories regarding the environments of black holes. You know, so this is a 102-year-old predictions that we finally may have the data to test. And it's, like I said, it's a cool story of multi-telescope, multi-team coordination. And it's fun.
Mm-hmm. It's one article from Scientific American here on what does a black hole look like. You got some diagrams and things like that to get an idea. Yeah, I kind of didn't even think about this. A black hole with stuff circling around it. Well, that's our usual way of detecting. That's a black hole because we can't see the black hole, but you can see the stuff circling around, like the center of our Milky Way galaxy. There's a lot of stars that move around this spot near the center of the galaxy. So assuming that's the center of the galaxy, and assuming that's a black hole because of how fast the stars move around. It's not real close to us. There are closer black holes, but it's a big black hole compared to the closer ones that are smaller. And the ones that are smaller are generally have a star orbiting around the black hole, and it's pulling off materials, spiraling in, creating X-rays and gamma rays. So the black holes are generally always surrounded by fuzzy stuff, like gas stuff circling around them. So you can't get right to that area, but that fuzzy stuff is the stuff that lights up. So I was thinking of, like, yeah, with this diagram, looks like it's indicating, yeah, the black hole should actually be able to maybe lens the stuff going around it. So you can see that the one kind of a drawing they have of a black hole is kind of like a cocoon shape, you know, where the stuff in front of it kind of circle around, but the stuff behind of it is kind of bent up by the gravity of the black hole, kind of lensing the stuff that's circling around behind it. It's like, yeah, that kind of makes sense. So it's all about how well you can get in right towards that black hole at 25 ish thousand light years away from us. And the bigger the telescope, more sensitive the instruments, the closer they can get in detail. Plus, it's, you know, got a lot of dust clouds in front of it, so you have to get rid of the dust clouds by looking at infrared or x-rays and stuff like that, and modeling what it actually looks like. So they're trying to get closer and closer to the stuff circling around the black hole. And that's the challenge. And they, you know, just doing a lot of calculations, too, to figure out what that stuff should look like, and then does it really look like that?
We had a question from the chat room while you were talking, from Aqua for You, about whether or not a black hole had ever been discovered in a globular cluster. And to my knowledge, yes, there was several years ago, about 5 years ago, in fact, and it was M22.
Okay.
Which happens to be my favorite globular cluster.
Up in the, near the tip of the teapot in...
Right above the handle in Sagittarius.
Sagittarius, yes. Yep. Nice bright one, too. Lots of stars. Good round shape to it. Good bright center to it.
Beautiful object. And boasting at least two black holes discovered in part by a team from Michigan.
Okay.
So, local interest story.
Would that be the University of Michigan by any chance, or another one of the college?
I believe it was University of Michigan, but...
Okay.
I will check, because, of course, it is very impolite to confuse the two, not just in an astronomy sense, but a sports sense.
Yes, indeed.
No, sorry, MSU.
MSU, okay.
Give credit where credit is due. Michigan State University.
Okay. Which I've actually been to their telescope. I've got one of the size of that telescope. 24-inch, something like that.
I've been to the campus several times, but never. It's always been for labor union activities and never for telescopes.
It's actually off campus. It's in East Lansing. So
yeah.
It's a little bit out the countryside. I think it's a 24-inch. I think it's bit of Richie Crichton design, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, that'd be a nice telescope.
Kind of a stretched out. I've actually looked through it, but when I was looking through it, I remember like the refractor on the side. I might have been like a 5-inch refractor. It actually gave a little better image just because it was looking through less turbulent columns of air. So a lot of the views, like in plants and stuff like that, was actually better through the refractor than through the main scope itself. The computers, they had those huge computers that were, you know, like 6-8 feet tall, a couple feet wide, and a foot deep or something.
Yeah.
They had a whole room full of those. The issues that they had trying to cool them off, they would like try putting air conditioners in the doorway, blowing on them to cool them off. I think they had like tape memory. Kind of like real type of tape. Yeah,
long ago was this visit?
It was a long time ago. It was like the late 70s.
Okay, that makes more sense of everything. You're telling me about these giant computers. Like, really?
Uh-huh.
Really?
Yep. Yeah, more, you know, like the what was that, Commodore 64 probably had, you know, more memory than those giant computers that they had back then, too. But I remember those days. Some people doing photometry through that scope. Stuff like that. It was fun, though. I think I did some imaging, too. Yeah, we took some pictures. Some, maybe not glass plates, but I think film, but plate film, kind of bigger stuff, like 4x5 inches or something like that. And developing it in their darkroom. Fun stuff. Got a bit of a launch coming up tomorrow. In fact, in only 5 hours, 18 minutes, and 43 seconds... launch of Expedition 51 crew to the space station coming up. So tune in to NASA TV and watch that launch. And then it doesn't look like until Thursday, I think. No, sorry. Thursday launch. Saturday's when they actually dock. Capture and installation of orbital ATK Cygnus to ISS. So that means, like several days in between, there's a better chance of being able to see the two craft flying together. So check on Heavens Above after the launch. Find out where that space station is going to be. See if it's going to be over your location when we get close to close to docking, and maybe you'll actually be able to see both of them together. Been meaning to try that with one of the smaller capsules compared to, you know, the space shuttle. Maybe we'll get a chance this weekend.
Cool.
You never know. But I'll have to look up, like I said, heavens above and find out where the space station's going to be. Might not be anywhere near us on Saturday. Not too unusual for that. Cassini's heading towards its final close encounter with Titan.
Long farewell of Cassini.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember if it actually did the fly through between the rings and Saturn yet. I'm trying to remember that. If you want to read further, I'll go to the NASA website.
It's supposed to start the dive on the 26th of this month.
Okay.
Yeah.
And whether it makes it or not, we'll see.
It's a goner anyway, so I may as well try.
Yeah, that's. I think that's the idea. So
designated termination date of the mission is September 15th, so we've got anywhere from the 26th through the 15th. It could hit a ring.
Mm-hmm.
But
ring particle.
It'll be a really cool ending.
Yep, and they're definitely going to get some pretty good close-up images of Saturn.
Oh, yeah.
From just a couple thousand miles or so from the planet.
Saturn as it's never been seen.
That's right. Some of the moons have been quite unusual. The, what's the moon? Atlas. Another moon with a very unique shape to it. Sort of a, they call it a flying saucer shape. Kind of like that. Kind of like a galaxy. It's kind of like a flat plate with a, you know, bulge in the middle. What was the other one that was really strange that they just flew by? Or was, I don't think that was a Pluto. I don't think that was a Jupiter moon. What was that other moon that had that really piece stuck in the middle of it, like a hamburger in a bun or something like that? Can't remember what that was.
I'd have to see a photograph to sum it up what you're talking about.
All right. Then maybe somebody in our chat room can
Space pierogi.
If that's it, yeah.
Comment from the engineering room.
And, of course, Juno still flying around Jupiter. I think it just passed, did a close approach to Jupiter, heading back out again. Was it take like a couple of months to go back out and come around back again? And always great images from the Juno mission going around Jupiter. Got a lot of close-up views of moons of the bigger planets in our solar system right now. And, of course, I like Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter.
Oh, yeah. That's the gift that keeps on giving.
Yeah. Always great images of Mars. New things. What was it? In fact, there was something that was not Mars. It was, what was it? The one that went around 67P.
Rosetta.
Rosetta, yeah. One of its images that they show were actually part of the cliff collapsed. I think that was on 67P. Or is that Mars?
Yeah.
I think it was
67. Well, the MRO just sent back some real nice sand dune photographs.
Yep. I might be confusing them. So I'm thinking maybe the cliff collapse might have been on Mars, and I was looking at a boulder that moved on 67P. That was kind of interesting. I'd love to see if that mission has any kind of gravimetrics to it and see if they've got a gravity map of 67P. I think it's got to be pretty weird.
Hmm.
Where up is down. You've got these like two lumps attached to each other. So you could be, you know, standing on one lump and look up and there's another lump. So which way is the gravity go? Does it go more towards your lump or does it go to the other lump if the other lump's bigger? I think it'd be kind of a very interesting gravitational field on there.
Don't think we're going to get to the bottom of that one tonight, Marty, because we are closing in on 10 o'clock.
We are.
We've got Commit Watch coming up next, I do believe.
Could be, but I didn't check, but could be. We have a Comet Watch coming up, yep. And our usual.
There are comets that we have not yet seen and would like to update you on as soon as we do see them.
All right, so say thanks, everybody, in our chat room. Really appreciate you being here tonight. Thanks for listening in, and don't forget, we repeat the program every 4 hours. Good night, everybody.
Good night, y'all. Clear skies.
hope that you've enjoyed this program from AFM Radio, the broadcast service of Astronomy.fm. This program has been released under Creative Commons license. Please contact us for details. You may find more of our AFM original programs on our website. It's really easy to find us. We are Astronomy.fm. You may also find us in the iTunes radio listings near the top of the News Talk section, and also as an iTunes podcast selection. We'd love to hear your comments. Please email us at radio@astronomy.fm. Thanks so much for being part of the voice of astronomy around the world and across the known universe. This is Astronomy.fm Radio.
AFM.